Greetings, welcome to The Dividing Line, back in the regular A&O studios, and lots and lots and lots of stuff to get to. I just saw this posted by James Lindsay, who is, you're not supposed to ever read anything by James Lindsay because he's an atheist, at least that's what some people say. He says, PSA, how the media primes the population for compliance. Here's how it works. One, X isn't happening. Two, what is happening isn't X. Three, X might be happening, but it's a good thing. Four, X is happening, but it's optional. Five, we need more of X. Six, if you oppose X, you're a bad person. Seven, X should be mandatory. Eight, opposition to X should be a punishable offense. Nine, people fired for not going along with X weren't canceled. It was just accountability. And 10, thank our leaders, we have X. What stage are we at now? That's, we're all over the place depending on which thing you're talking about. But yeah, that's pretty much how it works. Be watching. Okay. I'm not going to spend any, just be watching, for, developments that will eventually lead to either we need booster vaccines or we need new vaccines, and until the new vaccines are developed, we're back to lockdown. Just watch. Just may not be over the summer, but once the fall starts, just if you haven't figured out who these people are yet, I can't help you. It's global. I mean, I can talk mainly about what's going on here, but globally, those who want ultimate authority and a totalitarian system without accountability to an electorate, they think they've figured out exactly how to do it. And maybe they have. Maybe they have. Maybe they did enough work, groundwork, preparing the environment to accomplish it. We'll see. But just keep an eye open for that. In fact, if you want to know... if you want to know what these folks are like, did y'all see this? This was last week, but I didn't get a chance to play it. This was the Ohio House of Representatives. You have a representative, a woman, presenting an amendment to basically protect women's sports, to allow girls to have sports, because, as we know, with the immoral revolution, it's extremely anti-woman, and we have the woke Olympics coming up, and I will not watch any event that has transgender people in it. Just won't. I would have interest. I've always enjoyed the Olympics. I've always enjoyed the competition. But closing your eyes and engaging in that level of insanity, just not going to do it. So if it ends up being the woke Olympics, I'm just, you know, got plenty of other stuff to be doing, lots of books to be reading, so not going to miss much there. Here is a woman who is introducing this amendment in the Ohio House of Representatives. And so here's how the left behaves. This is just an excellent example of the left cannot argue this debate. They can't debate this issue. They are incapable of doing it. They know it. That's why they shout people down, censor them, because they can't debate it. So there's two different views of the same event.
Move to amend with Amendment 1594.
The chair has the amendment. The amendment appears to be in order. The representative may proceed.
Wonderful. The Save Women's Sports Act is a fairness issue for women to be able to achieve their dreams and athletics in our state.
And now, by the way, when it starts happening, watch the faces of the representatives behind her, too. I found that rather interesting, too.
It's crucial to preserving women's rights and the integrity of women's and girls' sports. Across our country, female athletes are currently losing scholarships, opportunities, medals, education, and training opportunities. This amendment will require schools that are part of the OHSAA to designate separate teams for participants of the biological sex. No school interscholastic conference or organization that regulates interscholastics shall permit biological males to participate on athletic team or an athletic competition designated only for biological female participants.
Okay, so there's the one shot, all right? Here is the shot where you see the people who are acting like orangutans, okay? They're banging on stuff. They're acting like you would see animals acting in a zoo instead of like you'd see people acting, you know, like in a legislature, you know, or actually raising serious argumentation. Here we go. So there's the guy. I looked him up. He's from an urban area, shall we say. Good Democrat. Yelling, screaming, pounding. This is the left. This is the left. There it is. There's no rationality. There's no reason. There's no way to debate these people. They can't debate. They're incapable of it. All they can do is yell, scream, pound. It's the brown shirts. It's the brown shirts from Germany. That's how it works. Anyway, I just wanted to touch on that. I posted a little article on, and if you have the Alpha and Omega Ministries app installed on your phone, then you already received notification when I posted my article. Isn't that cool? You're like, yeah, you're all up to 2021 now. Yes, we are. I posted a little thing there concerning the argument that was first made publicly, anyways, by Tim Keller in 2011, and then repeated by J.D. Greer in 2019, and then, as long as it's been said by J.D. Greer, it will be said by Ed Litton at some point about a year afterwards. The evidence of that just grows almost every single day. Whole new videos come out where, again, it's not just outlines. It's word for word. It is plagiarism on a level that is astonishing. I've said it before. Let me say it briefly once again. I do not know how you stand in front of any audience, let alone in the church, behind the sacred desk, behind the pulpit, and somehow act like what you're saying is coming from your heart when you didn't write any of it. You're reading something from somebody else. Now, look, I know people who have recreated Sinners in the Hands of Angry God from Jonathan Edwards, which, by the way, was probably just read from a manuscript in a rather boring voice. I know people who have acted out Spurgeon sermons and stuff, but everybody knew that's what they were doing. They would even dress up in the period stuff. Okay, that's completely different. It's completely different. I wonder how many people at Ed Litton's church have known for years, because they've gone back to, what was the earliest one now, 2015 or 2013? It's ways back. They have found these sermons that, again, were clearly lifted from primarily J.D. Greer, or maybe there's something new that's now come into it. We'll look at this in just a moment. But anyway, I wonder how many people at that church, when they go in there, go, our pastor doesn't really create sermons. He just rereads J.D. Greer's sermons. I mean, I suppose, you know, if you have this multi-campus stuff going down, what does it matter? I mean, you're watching a performance one way or the other. So I suppose that's why a lot of folks are like, we don't care, whatever. So anyway, I put this little article up, and the reason I did so was not so much the plagiarism stuff going on, but how bad argumentation gets repeated simply because the person who made the bad argumentation is granted some level of evangelical stardom. And so you've probably seen, it's not difficult to find, if you just look up Tim Keller and homosexuality on YouTube, I bet you it'll pop up. Just boop. An unbeliever was asking Tim Keller, probably in New York, in front of a primarily unbelieving audience, probably in a university someplace, just basically said, does homosexuality send you to hell? And so he wasn't. Obviously wasn't expressing the question in an overly useful or honest fashion, but this question was asked. Keller's response was, no. First of all, heterosexuality does not get you to heaven. I happen to know this. So how in the world could homosexuality send you to hell? And actually, the Bible, listen, this is true. Jesus talks about greed 10 times more than he talks about adultery, for example. Okay, so if you've watched it, you remember that Keller was clearly uncomfortable and he was clearly doing what he could to do the New York open-minded person thing. Okay? But there was the argument. First of all, heterosexuality does not get you to heaven. So how in the world could homosexuality send you to hell? Now, 8 years later, J.D. Greer, quote, let me say something very clearly. Homosexuality does not send you to hell. And here's how I know that. Being heterosexual doesn't send you to heaven. I mean, in terms of frequency of mention and the passion with which he mentions it, it would appear that quite a few other sins are more egregious in God's eyes than homosexuality. That was, I think, from the exact same sermon where he talked about God whispering, about sexual sins, and all the rest of that stuff. So the next year, of course, Ed Litton catches up in his plagiarization and says, homosexuality does not send people to hell. How do I know that? Because heterosexuality doesn't send people to heaven. That's in 2020. Now, aside from the repetition thing, aside from the doesn't anyone have original thoughts anymore problem, the fact of the matter is, this argument is so bogus and was so bad when Tim Keller first enunciated it, it should have resulted in laughter. Not only from the person he was talking to, but from the audience. Now, I think the only reason they didn't laugh at it was because they didn't even begin to understand it. What is the relationship? Who is making the claim that heterosexuality sends you to heaven? Nobody has made that claim. From a Christian perspective, heterosexuality is God's normative, created purpose. That's what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19. Pretty straightforward. That's how God created us. That's how God made us to continue as a people. And so he regulates that, and he places strictures upon how that sexuality is to express itself within the covenant of marriage and all that kind of fun stuff. But to even begin to try to make this argument, you would have to bridge the Grand Canyon chasm between the normative created status of heterosexuality and the perversity in the biblical author's language of homosexuality. Okay, let's bring these together. Let me show you how these are connected. They don't do that. Keller didn't do it. Greer didn't do it. Litton didn't do it because he can't do it. It's a laughable statement. It is a categorical error on the level that just makes you go, how did he do that? And how did anyone ever think that was a good argument? I mean, you have clear biblical teaching, homosexuality outside the parameters. It is against the created order. Heterosexuality is a part of God's created order, and therefore violations of its norms are also considered sin. So what sends you to hell? Sin. All sins, including homosexuality and adultery and fornication, and they're all sins. That's all plainly taught in Scripture. And so It was a bogus argument, utterly worthless argument at the start. So why does it get repeated all the time? Why have people stood in front of thousands of Christians and repeated this as if this is biblical wisdom? Well, part of it's because of the star culture in evangelicalism. Part of it's because people today don't recognize that you can appreciate someone and at the same time go, wow, they just face planted that argument. The idea is you either have to go all in or they're all out. So if Tim Keller, you read a Tim Keller book that helped you, all of a sudden the idea is, and so if he says this, then that needs to be helpful too. Well, it wasn't. It was bogus. He should come out and say, folks, I'm sorry. That was one of the dumbest things I've ever said in my life. You've probably never been in a situation I was in. I gave in to the pressure. I apologize. Please stop repeating the dumb thing I said. That's what he should do. Instead, what you get is the repetition of the dumb thing as if it's a wise thing. It's like, no, you can appreciate what he said over there and still go, but whoa, that one day. Because everybody makes mistakes and you can still appreciate things. It's that attitude that just a lot of folks just like really get hung up on that kind of stuff. So the article's up on the Theology Matters microblog if you want to take a look at it, including the image of those quotes that I just gave to you and where you can find the reference. Well, where you once found the references, we know that there are certain people who are now doing the Ergen Kanner thing and seeking to purge the internet of all evidence of everything they ever said at any point in time. So it's out there. It was out there at some point in time. Hey, did you see this? Just hit before I started. The Jen Psaki, man, she scares me. I mean, she's weird. She scares me. I mean, there's the real functional face of the regime. This is. Do you know they're going to be going door to door? Yeah, going door to door. I hope I'm home when they come by. Oh no. I'm looking forward to when those poor folks come by because I want to ask my questions. I'm going to say, okay, let's start with the 3 and 4 year safety data. Could you pull that out of the? Could you show that to me?
So they're going to find out what happens when Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses come to your house.
Oh yeah. Big time. Yeah, I'm going to have stuff ready to go, and we're going to be talking about pericarditis and all that fun, neat stuff, and they're going to be going, "You have a nice day, sir." They go hoping to find a Jehovah's Witness. I'm like, yeah, we got to get going. Yeah. Yeah, you all come on by. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be fun. Okay, speaking of plagiarism, by the way, I ended up doing 4 weeks in a row preaching an apologia. That was not planned. 4 weeks in a row, and I've been doing a series on baptism. I'm not sure how long this thing is going to go. I think we're at least 6, maybe 7. I need to go back and double check that. But let's say we're at 6 sermons right now. We got one more to go in Acts before we even get to the specific teaching passages on baptism. I've been looking at as examples so far. So I'm thinking 12 to 15 by the time we get done with this, probably. And so, obviously, at some point, that'll be made a list, made available for downloading for when all of our YouTube stuff disappears anyways. Here's my challenge to all the Ed Litton fans out there. Find the plagiarism. Because I can assure you, there ain't none. I can show you the notes I took in the pulpit, and in almost every single instance, It was simply a list of verses that I wanted to make sure to cover. That was all there is to it. What are you laughing at?
Are you seeing Twitter right now? Woke Bible?
Well, I remember.
Woke Bible just put up there, killing people doesn't send you to hell because not killing people doesn't get you to heaven.
I said in my article, I said that argument makes as much sense as saying murdering does not send you to hell because having babies doesn't send you to heaven.
Right.
That's exactly the same argument. And it's so absurd that I don't even know how it crossed his mind. But then it ended up on the internet, and then it started getting repeated. And it's just like, people, stop. Think.
I'm just waiting for all the memes to start coming out of this logic. Can you imagine all the different examples under the sun of
that was 10 years ago.
That's crazy.
It was 10 years ago. My whole point is this plagiarism stuff has demonstrated that really, really, really bad arguments will get repeated as long as you think that that's what people want to hear. That's here's the issue. I had never heard of this group, so I don't even know how to pronounce docent. I'm assuming it's D-O-C-E-N-T, sounds like docent. Docent, docent, docent. There's all sorts of somebody's last name. But the Docent Research Group. Okay, I'm sorry, folks. I don't live out there. Evidently, there's a lot of folks who are going, oh, yeah, they've been around a while. And it's just hard for me to express how foreign to my thinking the idea of getting somebody else to do your work for you. I mean, there might have been two or three debates where I've actually asked folks, hey, could you look up something along these lines? Could you find, I'm seeing stuff about this. There might have been two or three debates where I had one or two people that might have looked something up for me so I could find some reference sources, something like that. But all the rest, it's just all me. And it wasn't that they wrote anything for me. It says, oh, here's some references. Oh, okay, great. Like today, when we get back into Gregory, I left the Greek for Gregory's confession we've been looking at in the wrong subdirectory on my main laptop, which is at home. It wasn't in the cloud backed up one, so I didn't have access to it here. So I happen to have a good friend who is a church history expert, who was still awake, gives you an idea, he's ahead of me in time. I just took the shot, hey, do you have that available? I've got it now. So yes, there you go. Someone helped me out with that. And you might be going, well, who was that? Well, it was a resource that just provided for me. And you can sort of figure out how many church history professors do I know? Well, actually a few, come to think of it. But anyway, so that's complete. I just, the idea of walking into a pulpit or walking in and having somebody hand you your script. Because I've always, I'll be honest, when Greer does his, my left arm will always be three times larger than my right arm because I preach the entire time holding a Bible. But I'm not looking at the Bible. This is my manuscript. And so I stand there and this is how I preach. All the references and stuff are in the manuscript. So it's sort of like you walk in, here's your thing. Here's what you need to do. I can't preach that way. And it would never cross my mind that people do, but people do. And so I discovered this Docent Research Group. And Bob Gagnon. And you referenced, Rich referenced a Facebook article from Bob Gagnon, where Bob Gagnon talked about this Docent Research Group where J.D. Greer had written an endorsement for them saying, you guys make me look good. And I'm like, what is a docent? What? And so I, you know, you do your quick search, DuckDuckGo search, and you pull them up. So here's here's one of the, it's a fancy website, you know, real great, you know, graphically rich type website. And so here's just one of the pages on the docent research group. And it says, it's pretty small there, but it says research details. Our research team offers services ranging from book summaries to congregational surveys to sermon prep and planning assistance. When you partner with Docent, you're extending your research capabilities and guaranteeing that you'll have the resources you need to do your job well. Learn more. Learn more. And so evidently, you can get an account. And I don't know what this costs. I don't know if it's a per sermon thing. I don't know if you can get an account and say, okay, I want you to, maybe you can like fill in a thing about how big your church is, how many people attend, what's the demographics, where are you located, and maybe you'll get back this really snazzy, cool thing that, you know, in your area, this is how you should dress, and you shouldn't have a pulpit, you should have a pulpit, this kind of music, you should, I mean, there are people that do that, so maybe this is something like that. But notice, book summaries to congregational surveys to sermon prep and planning assistance. And so when I threw this out, somebody on Twitter threw back, because one of the questions I asked is, okay, so are the people at Docent, are they ordained elders? Or who are they? I mean, if you get a sermon outline, do you know who prepared it? What where'd they go to school? What's their training? What's their denomination? What's their theological confession? Do you know? Do you literally go in and say, I want 70% Calvinistic, and I want millennial, and I want Gen Z? What, do you just like click stuff to... How does this work? I can't imagine, but evidently, because then someone else on Twitter had said, I think, if I recall correctly, it was Bill Roach. I think Bill Roach had said that when this happened, was it Bill Roach? I'm sorry, Bill, if it wasn't you. Someone had said, and I thought it was Bill Roach, that there's probably like a Q source. In other words, the reason there's all this similarity and the same phraseology and stuff like that is there's probably a Q source, and maybe it is Docent because more and more people are using it. I suppose that's a possibility. I mean, that's not what Ed Litton said when this first started coming out. He said that he had J.D. Greer's permission and knowledge and so on and so forth. So that's not what he said. It wasn't. No, I was using this Docent group and they sent us the same stuff. I don't know. But you have no idea who these people are. And so do you like get an outline and then check it out? Because remember, when Ed Litton first started responding to this, he's going, well, you know, we have this 8-person team. And so we spend time doing the language work. Really? Really? I'm sorry. If you're reading someone else's outline word for word, don't look me in the eye and say you did language work. Where are you going to stick that in at? Huh? Come on, you're not doing language work. But we do the language work and the commentaries and blah, blah, blah. We do all this work. If you're reading somebody else's sermon, why are you doing any of the rest of that stuff? None of it makes a lick of sense. But so you have the Docent research group. I think, honestly, everyone in every church has the right to know whether what they are hearing in the ministry of the word, in their services, is coming from the actual study, experience, and mind of their pastor, or from a nameless, faceless, second-year seminary student barely getting by making a few extra bucks doing sermon outlines and selling them online. Yeah. So, I think there are a lot of churches. I think there are a lot of churches where people should be going, hey, you know, hey, pastor, what about it? Yeah, I think that would be well worth knowing all about. Okay, now, this is a video that I was directed to a while back, and it's Dr. Frank Turek answering a question on Roman Catholicism. I, on Twitter, a couple of times, you know, sent tweets going, hey, let's, you know, I linked to it, and I said, let's have a conversation about this. I think this is really, really important. I wrote to his personal email address, and I've gotten nothing. I've gotten not even a polite, no thanks, gotten nothing. I can't prove that he's gotten any of this stuff, so maybe once I make comment, again, the invitation is open to have a discussion about this, because I think this is really, 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 really important stuff, and especially in light of what we've been doing for, I don't know, 30 years? Yeah, good 30 years in this ministry. Here is, you know, Frank Turek does these sort of off-the-cuff question things in various audiences. And so let's take a listen to this particular one. Here we go.
I have a sister who used to be a Christian and now is an atheist, and okay. I have a father who's an atheist, and I have a mom who she's raised Catholic all her life, and she's now living in my house, and we're struggling because she's dying, and she won't come to church with us. She's insisting that we bring her a priest, but we can't find a priest that she will approve of, because it doesn't meet her standard, and she won't accept my husband, who's an ordained pastor, and she wants to take communion, but she won't accept it from us. We can't win, and we can't seem to help explain to her
how... What is this, I mean?
We can't...
Okay, now let me just interrupt it for a second. It's hard to respond to personal situations like this in a public setting when you know nothing about any of the people involved. You don't know anything about the church. You don't know anything about their, really don't know almost anything about their theology. You can, it's scary to assume things because you can assume the wrong things and then give a completely irrelevant answer once they then clarify later on. So it's tough. It's tough dealing with the personal questions like this. But I would like to think that in light of what has happened in the past, in light of the Reformation, in light of the New Testament, that some of the response here would be, well, what's vitally important here is she seems to believe in this concept of a priest. And if you know what Roman Catholicism teaches about the priesthood, then we're talking about a sacerdotal priest. We're talking about a priest with special powers of forgiveness and special sacramental powers that are completely unbiblical. There is not a shred of evidence that the apostles ever taught anybody to ordain someone, call them an alter Christus, another Christ, and imbue them with sacramental powers of transubstantiation or anything else. That is thoroughly and completely unbiblical. And so the issue is to communicate what the gospel is. And the gospel for a Roman Catholic is what brings them peace with God. She doesn't have peace with God. She is looking to do something. She is looking to receive something to get peace, because Roman Catholicism, lacking a finished work of Christ, because in the Eucharistic sacrifice, you have the representation in an unbloody manner of the sacrifice of Christ in a propitiatory fashion. So it's not finished for the individual. Since you do not have the imputed righteousness of Christ, that's specifically denied, then you're looking to the sacrament to provide you with some semblance of peace as you face death. And so the Christian response here is to present the gospel, because you have someone who clearly has been given a false gospel. They are looking to something outside of the finished work of Christ. Now, the problem that we're going to hear is that those who have, who promulgate and have bought into what I call the mere Christianity position, and it's not specifically C.S. Lewis, it is the idea that Christianity can be boiled down to believing in God and believing in the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, and that that death, burial, and resurrection has something to do with salvation, but then you have to draw a very strong line and say, but we can't say what. In other words, people who say that the gospel and how you are justified before God is not a definitional doctrine of the Christian faith. Well, because there's so much disagreement. So you boil it down to God, maybe Trinity, death, burial, resurrection of Jesus, and then draw the line. You cut off the rest of the apostolic message, which included the gospel itself, and say, this is what we need to have. This is sufficient. This is enough. And we'll let God sort it all out later. There are a lot of people who take this position, and it's very popular today. It allows you to be ecumenical. It allows you to say, well, you know, I don't agree with what Rome is saying, but, you know, we're all still on the same side and all this type of stuff. Okay, so the difference in the response that I would give and the response that will be given is based upon that fundamental distinction. And I think it's a fundamental distinction that the apostles themselves plainly made. So let's listen in.
I mean, it's like, Jesus take the wheel, because even know what to do here.
Why not ask her this? Why do you think Jesus came, Mom? What would she say?
She said, well, he came to take away my sin.
Okay, and in the Catholic Mass, when they do the Eucharist, they believe they're sacrificing Jesus again.
Correct, and they're...
Okay, no, that's not... No. It's best to be accurate here. They are representing in an unbloody fashion a propitiatory sacrifice through making Christ present upon the altar through the miracle of transubstantiation, but they would never say, we are sacrificing Jesus again. That sets you up for easy refutation from the Roman Catholic side. Really easy refutation from the Roman Catholic side. That's not accurate. What is being said is thoroughly unbiblical, but you need to define it correctly to demonstrate that it's unbiblical. So don't make that mistake, because that sets you up for the solid Roman Catholic apologists who will make you look silly if you say things like that.
Consuming. Take the Eucharist, mm-hmm. but I was brought up in the Catholic Church, okay?
Yes.
So
they are consuming his body and drinking his blood.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's not something I'm going to argue over. There's no reason to argue about it.
Except that's what her faith is directed to. That's the falsehood that is causing her to look to a false priest and a false system for a false assurance. So I'm not going to argue about whether Christ's sacrifice is once for all or whether it is a representation that does not perfect. Here's where, if you don't have a meaningfully robust doctrine of the atonement, causes real problems. Real problems. Real world problems. Not just theoretical ones or theological ones. Real world problems.
But if she understands that Jesus came to save her, and if she puts her trust in him, she confesses with her mouth that Jesus is Lord and believes in her heart that Jesus has been risen from the dead, she's saved.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so what you have is the assertion that the Judaizers were not really anathema. Right? Because the Judaizers believed all that. There is no evidence in the book of Galatians that the Judaizers were heretical, that they denied the existence of God, they denied the deity of Christ, they denied the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. No, they believed all those things. What did Paul describe them as? The Greek term is pseudadelphoi, false brothers. And he said they were anathema. So the question comes down to, is the gospel necessary to salvation, or is it not? So to simply go, well, as long as you believe, because what does it mean to say Jesus came to deliver you from your sins? How? By what means? Is it not clear that the New Testament writers believed that what you believe about that is definitional as to whether you are walking in the light or walking in darkness? It's not only important about what you believed about Jesus, but what Jesus did. So, to go, well, as long as someone has just this, a partial confession over here, they believe falsehood over here. They're looking to, they have a false hope in a false priest and a false system, and the stuff I'm not going to argue about, because you said I'm not going to argue about the transubstantiation stuff and the mass stuff and all the rest of that stuff. But that's what her faith is focused on. But as long as she's got this stuff over here, ticket punched, we're good. And the result is, what you're saying is, don't try to communicate those things. Don't try to explain to her the finished work of Christ. The reason you can trust in him and not have to have some priest who is going to leave the room eventually, and now you're back to, well, was that enough? Because her eyes aren't on the source of salvation, the author and finisher of faith. I mean, really, when you boil it down, what's being said here is all that Reformation stuff, we blew it. We completely blew it. It was irrelevant. It didn't matter at all. You all made a huge mess, and it didn't matter. That's scary. It really is.
Just ask her that, okay?
Yes.
Any kind of ritual she wants to go through, accommodate her, okay? Because
any kind of ritual she wants to go through, accommodate her? Okay, she can't go through it, but how about circumcision? What did Paul say? You do that, and you're cut off from Christ. What? How do you say this? There's such a huge disconnect here. I don't even see how it follows.
Fine. You're not going to divide over that. Look, my mom is Catholic, right? She'll come to this church and she'll go to Catholic church the same day. Covering all the bases.
Right. I just can't get...
Yeah, you know, I would not laugh about that. That is not something to laugh about. Because what he's saying is my mom has no understanding of the vast difference between the gospel of this church and the gospel of that church. That's what's being said. And if you're really saying, hey, whatever religious rituals you want to do, hey, if you want to do the Jewish laws and sacrifices and observe days and Sabbaths and all that, you go ahead, no problem. I'm like, what happened to Acts and Galatians and Romans and all that stuff? It's been boiled down to we're not going to argue about that. Well, we have to. We have to. It's there in the text. And without the text, you got nothing left. Yes.
Well, I just keep thinking about all the circumstances in the Old Testament where, you know, they kept bringing in all the foreign gods. Let's have a few ceremonies with them, too. Let's do some Baal stuff, huh? I mean, Revelation 2, big deal, right? You know, all those churches that were, you know, Jesus was upset with and called them names?
Well, you know, you're talking about the churches there. You're not talking about those individuals, I guess. I don't know. But I was going, what?
She knows how she's saved.
Okay, right, backing it up here.
I mean, I just can't get it.
But she understands the gospel. She knows how she's saved.
Okay, if she understands the gospel, why is she still going to the Roman Catholic Church again? Because this definition of the gospel has been so minimized as to cut out all the controversial stuff like faith alone, grace alone, Christ alone, all that gone. That stuff's that maybe even Paul was wrong to have been arguing about that stuff. Who knows? But he was.
It's not where you go to church that saves you.
Right.
That's true. It's not. It's the message that you believe in. And this woman believes she needs a priest who's called an alter Christus to bring her peace with God before she dies. That should tell you she's not trusting in the gospel.
This is why I get a lot of questions from people, because mostly I go to Protestant churches and I'll get a question from someone who'll say, do you think Catholics can be saved? And I always say, look, I even think some Baptists can be saved.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Now that's really smart. But what does that, I mean, I certainly don't believe all Baptists could be saved, but why not? Because all Baptists aren't trusting in the gospel. But the issue here is Rome's gospel a saving gospel? It would be so much easier for me to say yes. It would be so much easier, especially these days with all the pressure upon us to get along and cooperate and all that, for me to simply go, you know, sure, why not? And then you get into, you know, the conversation that Doug Wilson and I had a number of months ago on Sweater Vest Dialogue, where we were talking about G.K. Chesterton. And you know, obviously, Doug thinks G.K. Chesterton was better than his theology. And he's certainly hoping he was. But even he had to say, look, if his trust was really in that broken reed, in that false system, then yeah. I just feel like from what he said that really wasn't where it was, even though that's what he said. And so we come at that from different perspectives. I understand what he's saying, but it doesn't change the fact there's still only one gospel. There's still only one message. And Paul said to those individuals who would think that there was anything they could add to the work of Christ that is appropriated solely by faith through God's grace, that they're cut off from Christ. That Christ will not be a co-savior. It would be so much easier if that wasn't in the text of Scripture. And I do sit there and go, I so hope in my heart that this individual and that person in that denomination over there and that denomination, I really hope that their true faith is better than their profession. But I must extend myself to try to warn them that what you're saying is false. What you're saying is destructive. If I care for them, if I love for them, and that makes it tough. That makes it hard. There's no two ways about it. But just skipping it doesn't do us any good.
Because it's not where you go to church. It's whether or not you've accepted the free gift of salvation.
Correct.
If you're looking for a priest to give you peace, you have not an understanding of what the free gift of salvation is. Right?
So correct. You need to just, if she's accepted the free gift of salvation, Mom, when you're dying, you can have anything you want. You want me to bring you a Big Mac every whatever you want, Mom?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So yes. I would back off arguing with her and just right. See if she's saved. If she is, just give her whatever she wants. Give her gummy bears every meal.
Right.
Okay?
Well, no, now here's the issue I have. Well,
all right.
Okay, that's meaningless. I'm sorry. That's just, that's making light of a rather important subject. Gummy bears and cheeseburgers? What? She's asking for a priest. She's asking for a sacerdotal forgiveness from Rome. That's what she's asking for. That means her faith is not focused upon a finished work of Christ. And it'll never give her peace. And so you're just to back off and leave her in that situation? Is that really what we're being told here? Not my response.
She believes that if she cannot give confession,
mm-hmm.
she's going to die in her sin. And
right, because she's a good Orthodox Roman Catholic and doesn't understand the finished work of Christ and doesn't have peace with God. Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. They don't believe that. Who is the blessed man of Romans 4, 7 through 8? In Roman Catholicism, there is no blessed man because every sin you commit is imputed to you because there is no non-imputation of sin. So yes, whether Christ's righteousness is imputed to you or not is central to the gospel. That's the whole point. Yep, it's right there.
What do we do when she won't approve of the person we're bringing her?
Well, if she won't approve of the person you're bringing her, then she really must not believe she's going to purgatory to burn off her sins that are unrepentant before she can go to heaven.
Okay, now Dr. Turek says he's a former Catholic, but he does not understand Catholic theology. Okay, he's got some pretty shallow understanding. Because that's not what purgatory is. Okay, in fact, I happen to have but the rate we're going, I'm not going to get to it. But I was going to talk a little bit about a debate that I heard part of. We'll get to it next time. Called The Birth of Purgatory. This is Jacques Le Goff's work on that subject. But purgatory is for those who die in a state of grace. She said she's concerned about dying in her sins. No. You must die in the state of grace. You must be justified. Purgatory is for the purging, not of the sins that you didn't get forgiven, but of the temporal punishments of sins over against the type of punishment, mortal punishments that destroy the grace of justification. So that's off to the side. If she's afraid of dying in her sins, that's a salvation issue, even Roman Catholicism. So purgatory, satis passio, is the suffering of atonement in purgatory for the temporal punishments of sins rather than eternal punishments of sins. So Dr. Turek doesn't seem to understand what the distinction is and hence is missing being able to give a proper response to this woman. And if anybody knows who this lady is, would you let her know? There's other people who can provide a better response. And that is, she is trusting in a system rather than the finished work of Christ. And that's a false gospel.
Because if purgatory is true, and I don't see biblical support for it, but if it is, I'd grab any priest off the street and say,
right. Hello.
Before I'm about to go. Right?
Yeah, okay.
Okay?
Great, thank you.
All right, thanks, sir.
Well, Frank, if you'd like to talk about that, I think it would be very useful to folks. We could do it in the big studio. And because I think I don't believe that was a response that is consistent with the Reformation. I really don't. And explaining that more fully might be useful on a lot of lines. It might be. Okay, I knew I was going to get late on this, but I want to spend at least a few minutes. We may go a little bit longer, but I wanted to get back to it at least for a few minutes because I'm really enjoying it. I don't know if anybody else is, but we started a response. We commented on, remember Dale Tuggy was on Jake's, the Muslim metaphysician's thing, and he went off after me just unprompted, just went off after me, and I hate William Lane Craig, and he was lying about me and all the rest of stuff. And, you know, they're afraid of William Lane Craig because they don't understand it. They're just not philosophers. And just this incredibly arrogant, dismissive, I mean, he must run into walls a lot with his nose so high up in the air type of stuff. But one of the comments that he made was that there were no Trinitarian theories until well after the Council of Nicaea. Now, I think Dale Tuggy really thinks that he is so advanced in this field that he can actually make up phraseology and all the rest of us just simply have to agree with whatever it is he says. But it is so painfully obvious to the rest of us benighted folks that, for example, Ignatius, in the last program I read from Ignatius's incredibly high Christology of Jesus in his letter to the Ephesians, where he talks about there's one physician, generate, ingenerate, God and man, true life. I mean, very much the same language that you're going to end up with at Nicaea. Super high Christology, hypostatic union level type stuff. And yet this is 107, 108 AD. And we can trace this kind of belief from the most primitive sources back into the New Testament itself. And so there is a continuity. Are there people who have lower views? Of course, but there is a continuity of the best that comes from the New Testament all the way through Nicaea, all the way through to Chalcedon. And so one of the examples that we are looking at, in older works, you'll see his name is Gregory the Wonder Worker or Thaumaturgus. But it is a little more consistent to say Gregory of Neo-Caesarea because it's, John Chrysostom, Golden Mouth. Okay, so there are some that are identified with some type of name other than where they were. But Gregory of Nyssa, Basil of Caesarea are generally geographical descriptors. Anyway, so around 265, so 60 years prior to Nicaea, Gregory wrote a confession of faith, and we've been looking at it. And I hope you find it as interesting as I do. I had actually make a lot of mistakes. I left the PDF of an article that has the Greek of it in the wrong subdirectory at home. And once again, a dear friend of mine rescued me and sent it to me so we could look at it. But what we were looking at was the description given of Jesus. We already saw that the confession, as Gregory wrote it, is laid out very similar to the Nicene symbol. So you have one God, one Lord. And we looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 8, and we saw how Paul takes the Shema and he takes the Greek of the Shema, the translation of the Greek Septuagint, and he expands it out and makes application to Father and to Son, but he applies the divine name, Kurios, Yahweh, to Jesus. And so, though people will look at there is one God and say, that's the highest, and then what Lord is lesser than God, that's not what you would get if you were reading the Shema in Hebrew. And so, back last week, as we were wrapping up one of the programs when I was on the road in the fifth wheel, we had just started looking at, we had read through the description he gives in the second paragraph, the one Lord. And it has been well said that the driving force in the clarification of issues regarding the Trinity was the New Testament revelation of who Jesus is. And I've said that all along. What is the essence of the revelation of the doctrine of the Trinity? It is the person. Oh, you're trying to put that up there? That's not never going to work. Too small. I just got those there so I can see them. And the Greek is almost too small for me to see. The driving force is the revelation of who Jesus is. The essence of the revelation of the Trinity is the incarnation, death, burial, resurrection of Jesus Christ, outpouring of the Holy Spirit. Happened in time, happened in history. It takes place between Malachi and Matthew. And everything written in the New Testament afterwards is written in light of that revelation is taking place in history. So the New Testament is a Trinitarian book. It's written by experiential Trinitarians who had experienced and now were experiencing the presence of this great revelation of the one God in their own experience. So when you look at the description of Jesus here, it is rather full. Again, this is still 110 years approximately after the incredibly high views of Ignatius. So we shouldn't be surprised by this. And can we recognize that some of the language is now being influenced by the fact that the church is needing to answer objections? The age of the apologists, 100 years earlier, Celsus's attacks, the true doctrine upon the Christian faith and things like that. Yes, definitely. But listen to what is said. There is one Lord, the only one from the only one. That's manos ek manu. Manos ek manu. Only from only. Now, immediately, you have to recognize what is behind this is a recognition of the unique nature of Christ. You would never use this language of a mere creature. Who would ever say manos ek manu of Moses or Isaiah or of an angel, Michael, Gabriel, whoever? No. And yet there's a distinction being made. Manos ek manu. So there's no confusion of the persons, and yet there is the same nature, unless you're going to have multiple gods, which the very first phrase was heis theos. The next phrase, theos ek theou, God from God. That's Nicaea. That's Nicaea, God from God. So is Gregory the one that made all this stuff up? No, because we've already seen that this is consistent with those who've gone before and their confessions of faith. God from God. Not a God from a God or a lesser God from a greater God. All of this language is seeking to do justice to the depth of the New Testament revelation. which is why all Unitarians have to absolutely gut the New Testament of its depth of revelation about Jesus. They have to. Watch any Unitarian just lose their minds on John 20:28. It's always sadly entertaining to listen to Unitarians try to explain Thomas's confession. But Thomas would have understood theos ek theou, because that's what he was saying. Character kai icon tes theatetas. Now, I talked about this briefly. I was sort of rushing into it last time. So if I'm going back over something, don't worry about it. I realize that I am. Character kai icon, character and image, tes theatetas. And I think this is sort of where we had to speed up last time, because I did mention to you, but look it up, that this is the very term that is used in Colossians 2:9. Hati en auto katoikai panta pleroma tes theatetas somatikos. For in him is dwelling all the fullness of deity in bodily form, that which makes God God. The very essence of God. It's a high term. It is more specific in its definition than theatetas or theot, which is translated by the King James as Godhead. Unfortunately, they also translate theatetas as Godhead. So the King James, sorry, going to lose a few people here, but the King James rendering of these phrases is inferior. New King James recognizes that. Modern translations recognize that. This was an area that the King James translators, as great as they were, didn't do the best job. They did not recognize or did not bring out the distinction that you have in Romans 1:20, his divine character, theates, versus theatetos. So in Colossians 2:9, it's that fullness of what makes God God that dwells in him in bodily form. And so that's how he can be the character. That, of course, is the term that is a stamped representation, an exact representation, which again makes no sense of a mere creature. You cannot have the very essence of God stamped upon a creature because it's too big for the creature. The creature is way too small. Let alone to identify the kurios as the icon of deity. The reason that we can have absolute certainty that we know who God is and what his purposes are is because we have Jesus. Because we have Jesus. He is his character and icon, image. Hence, he can be the perfect representation to us of God. The logos energos, the all-accomplishing logos, or it's the energetic logos. And that term energos, the energia, the energies, in Eastern theology, really different, again, Western folks struggle mightily to even begin to try to build categories in our minds for Eastern Orthodox thinking about the energia and about things like this. It's very rare for Western thinking Christians to even make the attempt. Obviously, that can be taken and become incredibly unbiblical in practice. So when I was in Ukraine, my dear friend took me to various places. We went to some Orthodox churches and some shrines and things like that. And he was talking to me about how the Orthodox women will go to places where the energia is. And to be honest with you, functionally, it ends up taking on the same folk religion type thing that we were just talking about with the woman who's wants the priest. It's a, I need to go to a certain place. I need to have a certain person. It's that sacramental concept that once it's divorced from biblical revelation, creates all sorts of havoc and falsehood. But the energetic the Logos is the one creating and sustaining, and so he has power. He is doing this maintenance of these things. The wisdom who embraces the fashioning of all things, the Sophia, again, very common for people to have seen echoes of who Jesus is in wisdom in the Old Testament, especially in Proverbs, because wisdom is involved with creation. And of course, the Logos being the word of the wise God, you see the connections that are there. Obviously, Unitarians try to then go, well, wisdom was created, and as if God was once unwise. I'm not sure how that works. But anyway, they try to go that direction with it. But how do we know of God's wisdom except that he has revealed that in what he has accomplished? And the greatest revelation of that is, of course, the person of Christ. But again, all of this terminology, and I haven't gotten through all of it, all this terminology could never, ever, ever, ever be applied to a mere creature. It's not possible. And so here in 260, long before Nicaea, decades before Nicaea, and in consistency with those who went before, and we could trace this line from Ignatius, the epistle to Diognetus, Clement, the real Clement, Irenaeus, we can trace this line through and see the consistency all the way back to the New Testament documents. It is important to be able to recognize that. But I've now gone 12 minutes past when I was supposed to go. I apologize for that. I knew I was going to go long, but I figured since I had made the effort to grab hold of this information. And I even said, I said, you know what? I'm probably going to get so involved in everything else that I won't even get a chance to get to this. So I sort of felt guilty if I didn't at least start going there. I should make a note in this here so that I know where to pick up. Yeah, right there. I'll find a way to mark that or something. Yeah, hey, I marked it. Question is, will it save it? That's the question. Anyway, so we'll try to pick up at that point because I think it's extremely useful to be able to work through Gregory's confession. I find it very, very encouraging, just as I found encouraging to see manuscript P72 years and years ago in Denver, connection to the early church, that the fact that Christ has been building his church and it's continuing to be built. And we need that confidence these days as there are great forces arrayed against us. So, anyway, all right. So, Rich does all the practical stuff around here. So, he just reminded me, because he's got to pay all the bills. Yes, travel fund. We have a trip coming up. Starting, I think the 27th, the 28th of July is when I head out. And, so you'll be seeing the programs on the road again. But that's going to be taking us up, to Colorado Springs and to Denver. And, we've got one stop in Montana and then we're up at, Moscow, and I'm going to be doing all sorts of stuff up there. In fact, I haven't checked mail since the program started, but I had to write up to the folks in Moscow and say, how are we going to do all this? We need a schedule here. Do I need to stay a day longer? Haven't heard back yet. So we'll hopefully be looking for that. But long trip. And so if you want to help those things happen, and we have the travel fund is available at the support page at aomin.org. And make sure to download the app as well. And once I get specific topics, which I should get here pretty quickly, for Colorado Springs with Jason Lyle, we'll throw that up. That's something we can throw in the app too, isn't it? Don't you think?
Is that so? We can throw that in the app. We'll also reactivate something we haven't put up in a long time. And there's actually a speaking schedule calendar. And we'll put that stuff in there so that people can know where you're going and da 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 da.
So the trolls can hunt me
down. You know what? There are going to be trolls wherever you go. We know this. You can run, but you can't hide. So
famous last words. Someone's going to replay these someday.
We're finding that a lot of folks are still kind of catching up on some of the things that we're throwing out here. So get the app. Send us an email about your church. We need your contact information, where you're at. This is not, we're going to schedule it right now. This is, we're building a map. We're building a map so that when he goes from point A to point Z, what's in between and where is he going to be stopping and is there somebody nearby on the map?
Right.
And then we'll contact you and set something up. So please, road trip at aomin.org. Road trip at aomin.org.
Right. Okay. Now we did all the necessary things to do to keep Rich happy. All right. Thanks for watching the program today. We'll be back sometime later in the week, probably normal schedule. It's a fairly normal week, but lots more to talk about. And we'll see you next time. God bless.